Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Paul Rodney on behalf of the appellant James Harrell, who was the defendant in the criminal trial below. I'll try to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal today. The issues before the court today pertain to ensuring the fundamental fairness and integrity of a trial and a criminal proceeding. That's always a very important concern, perhaps the utmost concern, in any criminal trial. And it's highlighted in this case because of the truly substantial sentence that Mr. Harrell was facing based on the way he was charged. Mr. Harrell was charged as a habitual offender. Therefore, at trial, he was facing upwards of 850 years in prison. And that doesn't determine that the proceeding should have extra fairness, but it highlights the fact that fairness is of vital importance to a defendant facing that kind of sentence. There are roughly two categories of error identified in this case. The first category occurred at trial, and the second category occurred during the sentencing phase, during the proportionality review. And I'd like to start by looking at error at trial. The errors at trial, in particular, occurred during the testimony of one very significant prosecution witness, whose name was Detective Budin. He was the investigator of the case. He directed the crime scene investigation and conducted the post-incident investigation. His testimony was particularly important to both sides in the trial. For the prosecution sought to elicit testimony from Detective Budin regarding the completeness of the investigation. And through Detective Budin, the DAs sought to show the thoroughness and the sort of comprehensive nature of the investigation that took place to convey to the jury that the jury had a complete picture of what happened in the incident.
Why does that matter, given the identification of the defendant by many victims, his apprehension basically running out the back door, and his confession to the transport officer, even if the jury was unimpressed with Detective Bowden?
Mr. Harrell, we contend that this rises to a constitutional problem. The judicial and prosecutorial vouching for Detective Budin rises to a constitutional level. And under a constitutional harmless error review, the standard is upon the people to show that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And to show harmlessness, they must show that there was no reasonable possibility that the evidence contributed to the conviction. It's true that...
Is there a reasonable possibility?
We contend that there's a reasonable possibility that Detective Budin's testimony did contribute to the conviction of Mr. Harrell. And it's not strictly a question of identification. I should clarify that. It's true that there were 18 witnesses who testified at trial, so there was much evidence introduced at trial. 13 of them were people either inside the store or immediately outside the store, customers or witnesses or employees. Of those, two were able to identify Mr. Harrell in court. They evidently, his eyes were distinctive enough that they could just identify him by his eyes. The accomplice, who was tried separately, wore bandanas and had hoods over their heads. So most people couldn't identify Mr. Harrell. Two witnesses claimed that they could. And while they made an in-court identification, I think it was up to the jury to determine whether that was a valid in-court identification. Detective Budin and the other two police officers who interacted with Mr. Harrell interacted with him after the incident, when after he had exited from the store. So it was a post-arrest identification. It's true, Mr. Harrell was at the scene. There's no question that Mr. Harrell was inside the store and then came out of the store. The question is, there are two questions there. One is, what exactly happened inside the store? Because both men had disguised their faces with bandanas and hoods. And the other question is, was there anything that happened before or afterwards outside the store that could relate to the jury's understanding of the incidents? A key theory for the defense, the defense's theory of the case, was that Mr. Harrell was not the leader of this incident, if you will, that he was a follower, and that there were other people who influenced him to participate. And that through that theory, the defense sought to show to the jury that Mr. Harrell was there, but was not the ringleader, if you will, and that might have affected the jury's understanding of the incidents that happened inside the store. The charges, there were 25 charges against Mr. Harrell. He was convicted of 23 of them. One set was kidnapping, and another set was false imprisonment. And it is that there was a reasonable possibility that the testimony of Detective Putin contributed to the jury's understanding of who was how authoritative Mr. Harrell was in the incident and what happened inside the store. There was a confession. Mr. Harrell confessed, as you pointed out, but there's no videotape or recording of that confession, and there's no written confession. So the only knowledge the jury had of that confession came through Detective Putin and another officer, Officer Sammy. The jury never heard Mr. Harrell confess because of the failure to record him. So it was extremely important to the jury's understanding of the case to hear what Detective Putin had to say. He could testify. He was testifying about statements that Mr. Harrell made that otherwise wouldn't necessarily have come in, or the statements that he confirmed from the other officer. Having one officer testify about statements the defendant made, again, it's up to the jury to determine how much credibility to give to those statements. Having a second officer testify about the same statements changes the balance, if you will, and I think adds more weight to that. Additionally, Detective Putin was not only the lead investigator, but he was the advisor to the DAs during the trial. So he sat at counsel table during trial. He interacted with the prosecutors throughout. He helped them with the demonstratives at one point. I think it's page 195 of the record, where he's showing, when they're introducing the gun that was found at the scene, he's demonstrating to the jury that it's been disabled so it can't discharge in the courtroom. So throughout the proceeding, Detective Putin had particular weight because he was sitting with the prosecutors throughout the proceeding. So anything that Detective Putin had to say, once it was affirmed by the prosecutor and the judge, had, we believe, particular weight in the jury's mind. The U.S. Supreme Court has identified two dangers that happen when a prosecutor gives his personal opinion about the truthfulness of a witness. The first is that the prosecutor has secret knowledge or other knowledge that's not available to the jury. And the second is that the imprimatur of the government is suddenly on that witness's testimony. Here, both of those dangers are realized, and it's doubly realized because the judge confirms exactly what the prosecutor has said about the truthfulness of Detective Putin. So it's not that Mr. Harrell couldn't have been convicted if Detective Putin hadn't testified. It's the way Detective Putin's testimony influenced the jury's understanding of the total picture of events. Detective Putin testified about post-arrest investigation steps. And part of the defense's theory of the case was that the investigation didn't yield a complete picture of what happened, and that there was somebody else who induced, or it was somehow involved in the incident and got Mr. Harrell involved. Now, there was a legitimate complaint that introduces alternate suspect testimony, and perhaps that wasn't introduced. If that's true, that it wasn't introduced properly at trial, and that's one issue. But more broadly, it was the defense sought to convey to the jury that there was perhaps a bigger picture that what happened inside that store, which wasn't completely clear anyway, because the two men had completely obscured their identity. There might be a bigger picture beyond what happened just in the store, and what happened in the bulk of the witnesses again testified about what happened inside the store. So the dangers, as I said, the two dangers there are that the prosecutor implied that they had knowledge about the witness's truthfulness that the jury didn't have, and that the government was endorsing that truthfulness. And with the judge emphasizing agreement with the assessment, that rises to a constitutional error because it compromises Mr. Harrell's right to a fair trial under the Sixth Amendment.
Are there any Colorado cases or U.S. Supreme Court cases that specifically hold it?
No, Your Honor. Neither the Colorado Supreme Court nor the U.S. Supreme Court have reviewed a case where, I should say, they have not reviewed a case exactly like this where both the judge and the prosecutor have made comments. The Supreme Court, both courts have reviewed cases where DAs have made comments, and the Colorado Supreme Court has expressly said that they won't draw a bright line rule, that it's improper to reflect on the truthfulness of a witness through a personal opinion, but there's no bright line rule for, it doesn't require automatic reversal. And I'm referring to Wend v. People here, which is a 2010 Colorado Supreme Court case. And there's a line of cases in which the Colorado Supreme Court has looked at prosecutorial comments about the truthfulness of a witness. These are cases where The DAs usually have said that a witness lied, and the court has made reference that it's any expression about the truthfulness of the witness. In the four cases I'm thinking of, the prosecutors specifically said in opening and closing arguments that the witness in question had lied. These are Wend v. People, Kreider v. People, Domingo Gomez v. People, and Wilson v. People. In all of those cases, it was just the prosecutor who had made a statement, and in those cases, the court did not find that it rose to the level of constitutional error. I think here the problem is it's not just the prosecutor who made the comment, it's also the judge who made the comment. And that changes the equation a bit. And
are there any cases in which an alleged vouching comment by a judicial officer has been reviewed for constitutional harmless error?
There is. The only case that we could find is Harlow. It's a Tenth Circuit case, Your Honor, but cited in our opening brief. And in that case, it rose to constitutional error. But the court, the judge administered a curative instruction at the request of the defense attorney, and therefore it was not deemed to be, it did not satisfy the standard in that case. I don't want to misstate to the court. I believe that was a constitutional error standard. It could have been a harmless. The choices are constitutional harmless error or general harmless error. In that case, the court definitely did not find that the standard had been fulfilled. So I hope to confirm that for you, Your Honor. In the cases I refer to, the Colorado Supreme Court cases, there were another way to distinguish them here again is it was just the prosecutor who commented, and in three of those four cases, there was no contemporaneous objection at trial. In Wend v. People, the court identified a two-part process for identifying the standard. First, we decide if the error was if the comments were improper and if they affected the defendant's substantial rights, and second, if there was contemporaneous objection at trial, then you proceed to a constitutional harmless error, and if there was no contemporaneous objection, you proceed to a plain error standard of review. So the facts of the case we had before us have not been analyzed by either the Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court, and the cases where the Supreme Courts of Colorado or the United States have picked it up have not used the constitutional error standard because of that difference in facts. It was simply a prosecutor. In all those cases, the courts found that the comments were improper and that they needed review, but it didn't rise to constitutional error in those particular cases. I see why I've just passed the time I marked for cutting myself off, but before I step away from the podium, I also wanted to point out, I think the second most important issue in this case is the question of the proportionality review, which is hard to do justice to because of the complexity of this case, but I would like to point out that this court, even on paper, is empowered to perform an abbreviated proportionality review to review the severity of the sentence. And as we mentioned in our briefs, Mr. Harrell contends that his sentence was grossly disproportionate to the harshness of the crime. Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee on behalf of the people, bar number 38141. On the vouching claim, I think there are two considerations that independently control this case. First, as the judges and prosecutors' comments were no more than a confirmation of the witness's oath, it was not improper. And the second and overriding reason is, regardless of what one thinks that the statements conveyed, given the record we have here, there's just simply no prejudice. It would not have affected the verdict in this case. Starting with first, that there was no error. I don't want to gild the lily too long on, you know, what is and is means, but I think there is a fundamental distinction between saying someone is here for something versus that they're doing something. Because just because you're here at a place for a purpose does not mean that you're fulfilling that purpose. I mean, for example, when I go golfing, I'm always there to win, but certainly that shouldn't convey to the court that I always do. And in this case, the court and the prosecutor statements were that the witness was here to make sure the truth occurs.
Is this a constitutional error standard?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I would put the court to Wend v. People that says when we're making the constitutional versus non-constitutional harmless error standard, the question of constitutional magnitude is whether it specifically and directly deprives the defendant of a constitutional right. Here, I think any claim of error is attenuated. It certainly does not directly and specifically violate any of the defendant's constitutional rights. So I'd certainly submit that it's the non-constitutional harmless error standard. But I think regardless of what standard that this court decides to apply, given the record here, there can be no prejudice. The defendant's argument is essentially that the vouching bolstered the detective's testimony, which he argues in his view was prejudicial because the detective was one of only a few witnesses to identify the defendant at the crime, and that he was one of the witnesses to talk about the defendant's confession. But both challenge aspects of the detective's testimony were cumulative and uncontested at trial. On the identification issue, both officers Sami and Fazio identified the defendant at the scene. In fact, it was Officer Fazio who was the one who actually arrested the defendant. So certainly on that issue, his evidence was the most probative on that point. Five other witnesses in the store, Miller, Poland, Jorgensen, Griswell, and McQuarrie, all also identified that the person leading the robbery was the person in gray sweatshirt, which of course was the sweatshirt the defendant was wearing when he was apprehended. On the confession issue, Officer Fazio also testified about the defendant's confession. I think it's also important to point out that both of these issues were uncontested at trial. Of course, given the fact that the defendant was arrested at the scene, it would have been absurd to argue below that he wasn't caught at the scene. So the defense, of course, didn't contest that. And as for the confession, during closing argument, the defense counsel never argued that the defendant never gave the confession or that the officers had mistakenly described his confession. Rather, they said that the defendant had lied in order to protect one of his friends. So apart from being cumulative and uncontested, I think the evidence we have here is also overwhelming. The defendant was caught at the scene during the crime and he confessed to it.
Did the defendant seek to have any aspect of the confession suppressed before trial?
I believe so. I can't remember for sure, but I do believe they found motion to suppress before. Turning of course for the questions briefly to the proportionality claim. I think the defendant's argument is that this court should look at the specific nature of the defendant's crimes in determining whether his 64-year sentences are unconstitutionally disproportionate. That's the wrong test. As cases like Close make clear, the issue is whether the triggering and predicate crimes are cumulatively and individually grave and serious. If they are, then the test ends. And here, there's no dispute that the defendant's triggering convictions, the burglary, the kidnapping, are grave and serious, and that his predicate convictions, possession of a weapon by a previous offender, possession of a controlled substance, and burglary are all grave and serious, as this and the Supreme Court have held in Close and Allen. So given that, there's no danger of disproportionality in this case. And I just would like to point out, I think there's nothing in the record before the court for carving out an exception to that general rule. In Marchand, the Supreme Court held that even when all the offenses that defense committed are grave and serious but nonviolent, a life sentence is constitutionally disproportionate. And I think the defendant's argument is really getting at the idea that he should not have a 64-year sentence because his convictions weren't that violent. But we already know that sentences that have no violence at all, you can have a lifetime sentence, and that's constitutional proportionate. So certainly there's no basis here to find an exception. So if the court has no further questions.
I have one. About this trial court's comment, which may have been inadvertent, but it is unfortunate because it leads to an ambiguity and part of this appeal. Would you, I know you have to argue for the Attorney General's position, but is your position that we should say this is okay and this trial judges can go right ahead and comment on the prosecutor's objection?
I definitely would argue for a categorical rule. I think generally, of course, a better practice would be for the court not to explain its reasoning in front of the jury. I think the issue we have here, though, is how the jury would have interpreted specifically what was said. And I think in the context of the statement, we're dealing with a very ambiguous statement. He's here to make sure the truth occurs. I mean, that doesn't really directly comment on anything, because whether you're telling the truth or not doesn't necessarily mean it's going to occur or not. Especially when we take it in the context of directly after the statement, defense counsel asks Detective Bruton whether he thinks his time would be wasted if there's no conviction. And Detective Bruton responded, no, that's just a part of the justice system. So I think taking the context in the statement itself, there's just no way the jury would have interpreted it as vouching for the witness's credibility. So the court has no further questions. I thank you for your time and I ask you to confirm the defendant's sentences and conviction. Thank you.
I don't want to spend too much time looking at the comments of the judge made. I think they mostly speak for themselves. The judge said, it would be different to say a witness has been sworn to tell the truth. It would be different to simply affirm an objection. Actually, it would be quite different if the prosecutor simply objected without a talking objection as he did throughout the trial. The fact that the comment was, he's here to make sure that the truth occurs, that the witness had been with the prosecutors at the table throughout the trial, conveys more than simply, this is a witness who's under oath at this moment. And I think that this is exactly the objection that the defense attorney raised at trial. The judge immediately disagreed, did not want to hear extended argument about this particular issue. I think there is a very reasonable possibility that this contributed to the conviction of Mr. Harrell. And under a constitutional harmless error standard, which we do believe applies, the people must show that beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that is a significant burden, and I don't think it can be met here. Even under a general harmless error standard, we still believe there's a reasonable possibility that this contributed to the conviction of Mr. Harrell, and that is what must be shown.
But let's assume the jury disbelieved everything that the detective said. Isn't there still ample evidence to sustain the conviction?
Yes, Your Honor. If Detective Boone never testified, they could have convicted Mr. Harrell. But once sort of the elephant is in the room, the genie's out of the bottle at the point he does testify. Once he's there, he's lent his weight to the prosecution. And he is, even though there was cumulative evidence about somebody wearing a gray sweatshirt apprehended at the scene, there was not cumulative evidence about the investigation that took place. Detective Boone was the witness who testified about looking for fingerprints on the weapon and on the cartridges in the weapon. He was the witness who testified about why there wasn't DNA evidence collected. He was he testified about why there was no video or audio recording about the confession. So it's true, there's certainly some testimony that was cumulative. Not all of it was cumulative. And the parts that were not cumulative were essential for the defense to show that there was a broader issue at stake than just what happened in the store. So we ask you to remand this case for a new trial. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.